I'm Sonia Rothwell, and this is Guardian Daily on Monday, January the 26th. On today's podcast, as the government considers yet more emergency measures to kickstart the economy, The Guardian's Larry Elliott talks us through the Chancellor's challenge. Why Barack Obama's latest policy move has provoked a furious reaction in Pakistan, and what it means for his presidency. And will a multi-million pound development based around the Titanic sink without trace? All that to come, but first here's Sandy Waugh with a summary of the news and a flick through today's papers.
The police will be asked to investigate whether two Labour peers have broken the law by offering to influence legislation in exchange for bribery payments. The Liberal Democrat spokesman Chris Huhne said he would write to the police today asking them to investigate a report in the Sunday Times. Undercover reporters claimed that Labour peers Lords Taylor and Truscott said they had managed to change laws going through Parliament on behalf of clients. The reporters claimed that two other peers said they were prepared to use their influence in exchange for cash payments. The major British steel company Corus is expected to announce big job cuts this week. Corus, which is Europe's second biggest steelmaker, has been affected by the cutbacks in manufacturing in industries like car making. The company has already brought in a six-month cut in production and cut 400 jobs in distributing. Now it's expected to shed up to 3,500 workers in the steelmaking plants. The first trial of the new International Criminal Court in The Hague opens today. A Congolese warlord, Thomas Lubanga, head of the Union of Congolese Patriots Army, is accused of recruiting children under 15 into his force. The United Nations says 250,000 child soldiers are fighting in more than a dozen countries, and they hope this trial will send a warning message to military leaders. Bolivia has approved a new constitution to benefit the native people of its country. The country's first South American Indian president, Evo Morales, hailed the result as the end of the colonial state in his country. But there could still be division over the decision. The new law improves land and political rights for native Indians. President Obama returns to Congress this week to try to push through an economic stimulus plan worth more than $800 billion. He's facing opposition from the minority Republican Party. It would be the US government's second big economic bailout. We'll have more on the new president's first acts later in Guardian Daily. The Guardian's been told that the British Chancellor, Alistair Darling, may also have to bring in a second package of measures to stimulate the economy. He's considering more tax cuts and short-term funding for industry, such as car manufacturing, in the spring budget. That's the main story on the front page of The Guardian this morning. There's other economic news in The Times, which reports that school and hospital building has been delayed by the cash crisis. The paper says most of these projects depend on part financing from private companies, which has dried up because of the recession. Financial Times also says that plans for the country's biggest wind farm are on a knife edge for the same reason. E.ON UK, which wants to build the so-called London Array project, fears the slump in oil and gas prices has threatened the project. The Mail and the Telegraph lead on the row over Labour peers, which the Mail calls the Lords for Hire inquiry. It writes that Lords rules say peers must never accept any financial inducement for exercising parliamentary influence. The Telegraph says that even if the Lords are found guilty in an inquiry, they will not lose their peerages. It reports that the most severe punishment could be that they have to make a public apology. The Independent also chooses a political lead story, this one from its most recent opinion poll. In spite of all the actions taken by the Labour government, its Comres poll shows the Tories have extended their lead to 15%. The paper argues the economic turmoil has caused the Labour collapse. The Tory lead has gone up 10 percentage points in 1 month. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
Alistair Darling will start work this week on plans for a UK answer to Barack Obama's green jobs agenda after accepting that a second package of emergency measures may be unavoidable if the country is to come out of recession anytime soon. Mr. Darling's rejected claims from David Cameron that last autumn's cut in VAT hasn't worked, but he's running out of time to find alternatives in time for the next budget in the spring. The Guardian's economics editor Larry Elliott has been weighing up the Chancellor's options.
Well, the government now expects the economy to be weaker this year than it did at the time of the pre-budget report in November. And that's because the final 3 months of 2008 were particularly grim. After the financial crisis of September, October, the economy here and everywhere else, for that matter, appeared to just fall straight off the edge of a cliff. And because that decline was so steep, 2009 looks like being unlikely to meet the government's forecast. And in the PBR, Alistair Darling was forecasting contraction this year of around 1%. And most of the current forecasts from the City Economist and Independent Economist expect the economy to contract anywhere between 2% and 3%. And that will be the starting point for the Treasury's own forecast when they come to do them over the next few weeks.
So what does that mean in concrete terms? Does it mean that the measures that they introduced in November just haven't worked?
No, it doesn't mean that. It means that without those measures, things might be even worse this year than they currently stand to be. What it does mean, though, is that the government is having to look at the economy and assess whether additional measures may be necessary to supplement those that were announced 3 months ago, the VAT reduction and the bringing forward of capital expenditure. So the Chancellor is starting work this week and is going to have another look at the economy and decide whether a fresh package of measures is required for the budget, which will either take place early in March or early in April.
Have you been given any hints as to what they might be?
Yes, the Chancellor used to be the Industry Secretary, and when he was Industry Secretary, he identified some areas that he thought were going to be of strategic importance to the economy going forward. I mean, these are areas such as pharmaceuticals, the creative industries, and in particular, environmental technologies. This budget will be the first, which also contains a carbon budget, which will sort of lay out Britain's carbon footprint for coming years. And I gather that if there are to be measures, then Alistair Darling is quite keen on them creating the right sort of structure for the economy going forward. So I imagine there'll be measures to improve Britain's home insulation and to spend more money on reducing our carbon footprint. The same sort of idea that Barack Obama is coming up with in the US, which is to try and create a new army of green workers and to use this opportunity to change the way the economy is shaped.
I imagine it's going to be on a much smaller scale, though, knowing Britain.
Yeah. Well, Obama's package is thought to be in the region of 4 or 5% of GDP, which in the States is something like $800 billion. A similar package here would be something like £75 billion. Now, if you think about the PBR measures, they were around £20 billion, which was considered to be a very chunky package of measures. And I would be very, very surprised if the budget in March or April is more than that. In fact, it may well be less now. The Treasury has not yet come up with any numbers because it's waiting to see what its own economic forecasts come up with. But given that we're already on course to borrow £118 billion in the next financial year, 2009-10, and that will be higher because the growth rate is going to be slower, the Chancellor will be wary, I'm sure, of freaking out the markets by borrowing too much. So this will be a sort of mini-me version of Obama's package, if you like.
Are we going to be able to spend our way out of recession if these packages do actually make it to policy?
$64,000 question. I think the government believes that it can, with a combination of interest rate cuts and special measures from the Bank of England and the banking package and some tax cuts and spending increases, shorten the duration of the recession and get the economy back on its feet more quickly. I mean, Darling has not given up hope that all those things will mean that we have what's known as a V-shaped recession, so that you go into it very quickly and come out of it very quickly. But it will really depend on what sort of traction he gets from the combination of all these things. Of fiscal policy, tax and spending is only one part of that. And I think that one of the backgrounds to this is that Britain hosts a meeting of the G20 countries in early April, and that's a meeting designed to come up with a common international response to the crisis. One of Gordon Brown's main arguments is that all countries need to boost fiscal policy. They need to either cut taxes or increase spending or both in order to have a sort of coordinated global response to this. So Britain will have to do its bit. So this green package, if it appears, which I expect it will do, is our part of that.
Larry Elliott.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Barack Obama's latest presidential edict has raised a few eyebrows among those expecting a break with the dark days of George W. Bush's foreign policy. On Friday, Mr. Obama gave the go-ahead for his first military action, missile strikes against suspected militants in Pakistan's tribal areas. Under Mr. Bush, US drones made 30 strikes last year in a bid to flesh out insurgents. But the response in Pakistan to the latest strike has been nothing short of outrage, as The Guardian's Saeed Shah in Islamabad explains.
There were two strikes which happened late on Friday, and we believe that 22 were killed. in these two attacks, both in Waziristan, one in South Waziristan, one in North Waziristan. And the significance really is that these were the first strikes under President Obama, showing that he's planning to continue the same policy of these missile strikes on these unmanned U.S. aircraft.
Pakistan has reacted in the past to these sorts of incursions because, as you say, that it's a continuation of President Bush's policy. What's been the response to these latest attacks?
Well, it's been a fairly furious response, you know, both from the government and, you know, from society more widely. I mean, the government has condemned them and has publicly stated what they say is that we had a sincere hope that the United States will review its policy about these drone attacks. The U.S. ambassador was called in to see the Pakistani president partly over these latest drone strikes. And, you know, the public at large is one of the few issues that can get people out on the streets in Pakistan and gets people very mad. This idea that Pakistan's sovereignty can be breached at will by the Americans in the tribal areas. And the thing that really gets people het up is this issue of collateral damage. You know, women and children, non-militants who happen to be close by any of these strikes, and they often get killed. It does place the government, and it's a very fragile civilian government, in a very awkward position, because on one hand it is dependent really on American support, and with American support comes an expectation from the Americans that they'll tolerate these strikes. But their credibility with the public is already very low, and a lot of people don't actually believe these protests by the Pakistani government. They think behind the scenes that the government has done a secret deal with America, with the previous regime of Musharraf and the current one, to allow these strikes to go ahead. So it does undermine the government a lot. I mean, the current government is not going to abandon the U.S. alliance, but if this government were toppled, there are many shades of other governments which could come, much less liberal governments that could come to power in Pakistan, who would question the whole basis of the alliance with America. Strictly speaking, you know, they are illegal incursions into Pakistan. These are on Pakistani territories by unmanned aircraft, which are basically controlled by the CIA. They kill people inside Pakistan. So the legal basis of it all is rather murky, and there have been stepped up in frequency over the last few months. And a lot of people think that if Obama is going to concentrate so much on Afghanistan, and he talked a lot about Pakistan and getting al-Qaeda, in fact, the frequency of these attacks will only increase under an Obama administration. And that will really test the alliance between Pakistan and Washington.
Well, that's the situation in Pakistan. Joining me now is the Washington Bureau Chief for The Guardian, Ewan McCaskill. What's been the response to these attacks in the States?
Well, it's been very muted. I think there's a sense that Obama has sort of demonstrated he's tough, that he's up for the commander-in-chief's job, just because he's closing Guantanamo and he's dispatching special envoys to the Middle East on peace missions. Doesn't mean he's going to be a soft touch. I think he wanted to send this message. He's prepared to take military action when necessary. So it was an important decision, giving the approval to commanders to launch these drone attacks.
Do you think this is to placate the many people who during the campaign were asking whether a Democrat would be up to maintaining the security of the US's borders?
It's exactly that. There's no doubt that, you know, John McCain, with his military background, you know, fighter pilot in Vietnam, had the experience of war. There's constant carping that Obama had no such experience. He'd never had to take those kind of decisions. And there were question marks about whether somebody without that kind of experience was capable of being commander-in-chief. So he sort of demonstrated that he's going to be tough. And he's going to be particularly tough in both Afghanistan and Pakistan. He said during the election campaign that he was switching resources from Iraq to Afghanistan, Pakistan. And I know from talking to people in his administration that he regards Pakistan as one of the most dangerous and volatile places in the world. So we're going to see a lot of resources directed towards that region. There's also Obama's view of foreign policy that George Bush made a mistake in giving up in Afghanistan too soon. The main threat is bin Laden, and that job should have been finished. He said repeatedly on the campaign trail, A, he wants to try and get bin Laden. B, he needs to try and stabilize Afghanistan. And three, identified Pakistan as a problem. And he said that if the Pakistanis didn't deal with the internal problems with Al-Qaeda and other militants crossing the border into Afghanistan, then he would order the bombing of Pakistan. So on the campaign trail, the rhetoric was tough.
So far, we've seen some of the policy decisions that Obama's made, and they seem to be him trying to put some clear blue water between his administration and that of George W. Bush. Are there any other surprises in store that might not square with Obama's image as the antidote to Bush?
Well, we'll also see maybe a tougher line towards Iran. Although there's sanctions and sort of threats of or hints of possible military action against Iran, the Bush administration didn't make much progress. So I think what we're going to see under Obama is an increase in those threats, tougher economic sanctions taken by America with help from countries like, say, Britain, probably not with UN support, and maybe even not with the European Union support. So we'll see an increase in sort of economic sanctions. The rhetoric will be sort of ramped up. And then on the other hand, what Bush didn't do, that will be combined with the carrot, or at least a bigger carrot, and that carrot will be the offer of direct negotiations with the Iranians, something Bush wouldn't do with regard to the sort of nuclear issue and the other difficult issues with Iran.
Ewan McCaskill in Washington. And you can see more analysis of the Obama presidency so far on guardian.co.uk/world. Elsewhere on the Guardian website, men get richer after divorce, apparently. Find out the secret at guardian.co.uk/lifeandstyle. Find out why teachers are being lured away from the UK to work abroad, guardian.co.uk/education. And Google has announced plans that will make listening to Guardian Daily on your own PC a thing of the past. No, it's not censoring us. Find out what it is doing at guardian.co.uk/technology. In future, you may not be able to get a meat option on the menu if you're receiving treatment in an NHS hospital. One of the ideas to help reduce the service's carbon footprint, which by the way is slightly smaller than Estonia's, is to take meat off menus. The Guardian's Juliet Jowett explains why they think it'll help.
They're publishing a plan which sets out what their carbon footprint is, so how much carbon they emit from their own operations and also from all sorts of things like people driving to hospitals and the production of the drugs they use, etc. And then they're going to set out a series of ideas for how that can be reduced over the coming years, short-term ideas that can be implemented quite quickly, and then some long-term ideas which they are in the report or hinted at, but they might also discuss.
So give us an idea about some of the proposals then.
Well, they range from the quite specific. So one of the ideas, as we've suggested in the story, is to have menus which don't have any meat options at all, because meat is a particularly high carbon ingredient compared to other things, particularly fruit and vegetables, pulses, that sort of thing. They want to look at reusing more equipment, reducing the wastage of drugs. A very small percentage of drugs actually ends up having a useful effect in medical terms for lots of different reasons. Stocks go out of date, people throw them away, etc., etc. And then there are some quite big aspirations about rethinking the way they do things. So in future, surgeons or other specialist staff could go to GP surgeries, and that way one person would travel to an area where lots of people could go and visit him with only short journeys to make, rather than everybody traveling to a big centralized hospital.
By the sounds of it, I'm sorry if I'm going to sound cynical, it sounds like cost-cutting with a green wrapper.
Well, I think that might be a little bit unfair. A lot of these things are actually sort of in line with what the NHS is already doing for other reasons. And I know that people who know more about the health service will understand that there are obviously controversies about that, but also good reasons for some of the things they're looking at doing for health reasons. All of these things probably will save money in the long run. Over what period will vary enormously from immediately to several years, perhaps.
The report you alluded to there was a massive carbon footprint.
Oh, it's huge. If the NHS was a country, it would be, well, back in 2004 when the last sort of measurements were taken and the last big international figures were available for it, it would have been the 81st biggest country in terms of carbon emissions. It's absolutely vast. Some people within the NHS think it's actually even bigger than that, but when I looked up the international figures, that's where it's at. It's one of the biggest organisations in the world, the NHS. It's the biggest employer in Europe. I mean, on every level, it's a massive operation.
And it accounted for, I think, 3% of all emissions in England?
Yes, that's right, yes, yeah. And it's 25% of the public sector emissions in Britain as well. So, you know, the government's committed to, as it is, to cutting carbon emissions by 80% by the middle of the century. Then obviously it's going to have to take a massive amount of responsibility for the public sector, and the NHS is a big, big part of that. I'm sure there will be people who think, why hasn't this happened before? You know, why have we waited till 2009 to be thinking about an ambitious strategy on this scale when this government's commitment to it has been around for a long time?
Juliet Jowett. Still to come on Guardian Daily, we find out what Asterix and a planning row in Corsica have in common. But first, one of Belfast's claims to fame is that the city's Harland and Wolff shipyard built perhaps the world's most famous ship, the Titanic. Now developers are hoping to cash in on that link and regenerate a whole area around the slipway that launched the ill-fated liner. But are the plans as doomed as their namesake? The Guardian's Island editor Henry MacDonald has been taking a look.
Unusually, this is a mainly private sector-driven investment. The City Council and indeed the government have some input, but it's they're minority stakeholders. This is investments by the likes of Dermot Desmond, who is a big shareholder at Glasgow Celtic and a big property developer in Ireland called Pat Doherty. It is in the main private money investing in Belfast's future at a time when, you know, people are very reluctant to invest in the banking systems in crisis. So this is an unusual bucking the trend type project. It's a 300-acre site, and essentially what they're trying to do is to tap into the brand name of the Titanic. So, for instance, I was standing on the very slipway under which Titanic dropped into the water after being built. On that site, they're going to build a four-dimensional museum to the Titanic and use it as a tourist trap. Very much in the way, for example, Guinness does with its headquarters in Dublin, attracting tourists from all over the world. But in addition to the tourism element, there's also a living and business aspect to it. The living will be several hundred apartments. The City Corporation Bank are coming to the area. They're creating 800 jobs in June, which again is bucking the trend. There will be a new further education college for 16,000 students, and there will be a media hub centre. There's already a film studio down there. So it's a very, very ambitious project that will roll out over the next decade. It's not an immediate investment. It's going to roll for 10 years and it's going to go in phases, but it's probably the most exciting part of economic development in the city of Belfast for quite some time.
I'm sure that people will be writing their own headlines with a quarter funded by private money, which is based on the Titanic.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean. This Titanic sunk, didn't it? Some people have injected notes of scepticism into the whole debate about the project. So far, the investors have put their money, they've put £100 million in. They're now ready to put another £170 million in. The question is, for example, will the apartments be occupied? Now, 100 are ready to go around about June time. The question is, what about the next phase? There's a whole raft of new apartments that are going to have to be built. Will the banks lend people money to buy these apartments? Will people live in them? And the situation at the minute is that a lot of these apartments are lying idle, empty. No one can afford to rent them out, or even in some cases the banks are taking them back off people that were buying them. So there is that worry about the property element, which is always there. And as I say, we are in a bit of a downturn in Northern Ireland as well as anywhere else in the UK.
Our Island editor, Henry MacDonald. What have an actor who was in the Asterix film, the man who introduced Nicolas Sarkozy and Carla Bruni, and the Island of Beauty got in common? Well, they're all embroiled in a rather ugly planning battle that people on the island of Corsica are hoping won't see their paradise home being turned into a concrete jungle like the Costa del Sol. Angelique Chrysafis told me why the battle is threatening to become a war.
Well, basically, Corsica is known as the summer playground of France and Italy's rich and famous. And it's also one of the last corners of the Western Mediterranean, which still has stretches of wild, untouched coastline. And this is because France has had very strong coastal protection laws in place, but also because over the last 30 years, there's been a separatist movement here. And armed groups have said very much that villas and hotels were part of the target there. So we've seen sort of empty villas being bombed for quite a long time to make a point. But now, in the last few weeks, the struggle has really got much bigger because the local executive in Corsica has now put forward an economic plan to boost the island by opening up some of this protected land and allowing it for building. So an island that was saved the building of the concrete horrors of Mallorca or even France's Côte d'Azur or Monaco is now likely to see much more building, ruining patches of its beautiful coastline.
And there's a direct line to the president, isn't there, in this story?
Well, yes, it's now got very interesting because, of course, the president himself loves Corsica. His first wife was Corsican. And he tends to move in showbiz circles in Paris. And we all know that a lot of Paris's showbiz stars absolutely adore Corsica and its coastline. And of course, once you've holidayed there and you've got enough money, you can afford to build your own fantastic villa. Now, what's happening is people have been getting round the coastal planning laws, and villas have been popping up in places where they shouldn't be. And that's partly because this is a very lawless island known for its clans, its mafia, its armed separatists and protection rackets. And so this row has now reached the president's friends. One of his friends, Jack Seghela, who's a publicist who introduced Sarkozy to his wife, Carla Bruni, has just had plans for one of his villas overturned in the south because it was encroaching on protected land. And there's another actor, Christian Clavier. Now, he has a villa in Porto Vecchio. There's nothing illegal about it, but just his existence has really annoyed nationalists. And last year, nationalists basically occupied the area around his swimming pool, filmed this in protest at foreigners, French foreigners occupying the island. And they were fined for this last month. And Nicolas Sarkozy was so furious that one of his friends could be targeted in this row over building that the island's police chief was actually sacked. This plan now, which is called the PADUC, this economic plan, which is going to open up land for building, is going to go in front of the Corsican Assembly in March and be voted on. There's a huge movement here. There's about 80 groups ranging from ecologists to trade unionists who are fighting to stop it. There are also nationalist politicians who are forming a new political party here next weekend, Corsica Libera, and they really want to get this stopped in March. They want this to be halted in its tracks.
But Corsica is a really poor island. Surely any extra money that's been brought in is going to be good.
This is exactly the point. Corsica is, as I say, known as this rich playground, but actually it's one of the poorest regions in France, and there are about 10% of the population living on really precarious incomes. And of course, you've got young Corsicans who are leaving because the land has now got so expensive there that they can't afford to buy a house at all. Now, economic people are saying that there does need to be a plan for the island, but their argument is that you can't just invest in what they call unbridled tourism, and you can't just have concrete buildings and redo the mistakes that Spain is so heavily regretting on Mallorca.
Is there any evidence that tasteless development that's going to take place there?
This is the argument of the people who are suggesting the plan. So you've got the Corsica Executive and the Corsica Assembly are both headed by people in Nicolas Sarkozy's party and his centre-right UMP party. Their argument is that they're only going to open up 10% of protected land in Corsica. Now, environmentalists say that's too much. They say, why go back on an island that has been protected and is now called the Island of Beauty and make it more like the Côte d'Azur, which has villas really encroaching on the coastline? The argument of the executive is, no, we have to develop this place, and tourism is the main, but not the only means. You have to look at what might be built. We're talking about golf courses and golf clubs, which take up a lot of water, and that's another environmental issue. And there's also an idea that could politicians on this very kind of plan-like island stand to benefit when land opens up? Could they do well out of deals? They deny this, but it's something that's very much poisoned the atmosphere in Corsica at the moment.
Angelique Chrysafis in Paris. That's it from Guardian Daily, from me, Sonia Rothwell, producer Ian Chambers, and the rest of the Guardian Daily team. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.